Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. This is Casey Luskin broadcasting from Seattle, Washington with Dr. Paul Nelson, who is here in our studio today. Dr. Nelson has a PhD in philosophy and biology from the University of Chicago. He is a very well-known proponent of intelligent design, and we have him in our studio today. We've been talking about common descent, and this is going to be the second of our podcasts on common descent. So thank you for taking the trip out here to Seattle, Paul.
It's a pleasure to be here.
And where do you come here from? How do you arrive in this part of the country?
I'm based in Chicago. My family and I live there and have for many years, and it's great for my work because I'm only about 20 minutes from O'Hare Airport, and from O'Hare one can get a direct flight almost anywhere in the world. So it's about 3.5 hours here from Chicago. I use that time to work on the plane.
And what's it like in Chicago right now?
It's actually very nice, mild, and things are blooming.
Okay, a little global warming perhaps? Or you guys had some non-global warming weather recently, is what they
reported. I can tell you we had a brief flirtation with spring, and then 4 or 5 inches of very wet, heavy snow were dumped on our flowers, unfortunately.
Wow.
But that's all gone now.
Okay, well, we're going to jump back into the common descent question, and we were discussing on the last podcast whether intelligent design is compatible with common descent, and you gave some very eloquent answers, but I think maybe there's some elaboration that could be helpful here. So what else would you like to say about the question? Is intelligent design compatible with the view that all life on Earth, all living organisms, share some common ancestor?
Yes, in fact, I will post at Evolution News and Views a figure from one of my talks that I think is very helpful to people in thinking about this question. I'll briefly describe it now. It's a matrix of opinion with four quadrants. Along one axis, you have design versus no design. Along the other axis, you have common ancestry and separate ancestry. Mm-hmm. So the common ancestry no design quadrant would be Richard Dawkins, Stephen Gould, most evolutionary biologists who think that there was a single tree of life that came about via strictly natural processes. In the separate ancestry and design quadrant, you have Cuvier, Linnaeus, most modern creationists, and the view that there was more than one tree of life, a forest of trees, and that those were brought about by intelligent design. Now, the other two quadrants aren't as well known, but they're also very well populated. In the design single tree quadrant, we have famously Mike Behe, but also many members of the American Scientific Affiliation, many theistic evolutionists who think that there's real design in the world, yet there was a single Darwin tree. Now, you might say, well, that fourth quadrant is completely empty. There is no evolutionary biologist who does not accept common ancestry of all living things. In fact, that's false. It's spectacularly false. In the 19th century, Darwin was very much the exception in advocating for the common ancestry of all living things. Most 19th century evolutionists, Ernst Haeckel, Richard Owen, Chambers, Lamarck himself, had a polyphyletic or multiple starting points view of the topology or geometry of life. Into the 20th century, there are many prominent evolutionists, such as Leo Berg, the great Russian zoologist who was a mentor to Dobzhansky, held the view that life had multiple independent starting points. And in our own time, now in 2007, very senior molecular evolutionists such as W. Ford Doolittle or Carl Woese, or theoreticians such as Stuart Kaufman are actively considering the possibility that multiple starting points for life is as or more reasonable than Darwin's single tree picture. So every quadrant in that matrix of opinion is occupied by some prominent biologist or thinker. So design theorists and people in the design community should recognize that they have the same intellectual freedom that their counterparts do in evolutionary theory to weigh the evidence for and against common ancestry of all of life or some portion of life and come to their own conclusions. I think it's very important that we not sacrifice any of our intellectual freedom when we come to this question. One other perhaps helpful way to think about this Imagine that you see a photograph of a four-year-old girl, let's call her Tammy, standing atop Mount Everest. And she's really there. It's not a fake picture. She's really there with her oxygen mask on, waving wildly to the camera. And the caption of the picture says, "Here is Tammy, first child to climb Everest." And then there's a bit from her parents in the caption, and they say, "And she did it all by herself." Hmm. Now, should you believe them? Hmm. Well, almost certainly not. Tammy may have climbed Everest, but it's a sure bet that she did so with adult help all along the way. Now, take that metaphor and think about it in relation to the theory of common descent. Someone like Mike Behe could say, with great gusto, all living things share a common ancestor. That is, there's an unbroken lineage of ancestor descendants leading from the first cell to Homo sapiens. But Mike would also affirm that intelligent causation, intelligent design was necessary sort of all along that path. Mm. So these questions of common ancestry and design are really, in a sense, orthogonal to each other. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're related, but one can come down on them, you know, in different ways.
Sure, sure. Now, in the last podcast, we were talking about the origin of the genetic code. And, you know, you discussed the observation that there actually are a number of variant codes that exist and how that was a failed prediction of this idea that all of the codes have there's a single origin of the genetic code. And you talked about how obviously the common descent, pro-common descent community responded by saying, well, maybe there was an original code, but then it evolved. And you made the point that if you were to change the genetic code, you would radically destroy or mess up the ability of a organism to perform the fundamental function of transcribing and translating DNA into protein. So can you elaborate on that a little bit for us, Paul? Why is it difficult to imagine the genetic code evolving such that a codon no longer determines one amino acid and then it starts to actually signify a different amino acid? Is it possible for the code to evolve, or is this a reasonable response from those who support common descent?
Well, here's a helpful way of thinking about this. Laura Landweber at Princeton, who works on this problem of the evolution of the code, has described it as rewiring the keyboard of life. Mm. Imagine that you come to work on your computer one morning in the office, and every time you hit the letter M, a semicolon appears. Or you hit the semicolon, and the letter K appears, and so forth. In other words, the mapping from keyboard to character on the screen has been shifted.
Or it would be like if you're watching American Idol, and you thought that you're supposed to text one for Melinda Doolittle, but it was actually for Sanjaya Malakar, and then he ended up winning, right? I mean, pretty much the same thing, right?
Right. We count on these mappings from symbol to character and so forth to be consistent, and if they're shifting, instead of intelligible English prose or the right person winning American Idol, you have gibberish. Now, what happened when variant codes were discovered is people began to speculate about mechanisms or processes by which codon assignments could change. A codon is a three-nucleotide word, if you will, or letter assignment, to be more precise. So, for instance, UGA in the Universal Code ordinarily is a stop. It's a termination signal.
Pretty important codon.
Pretty important codon. So when these variant codes were discovered, almost immediately, people such as Thomas Jukes at the University of California at Berkeley began to formulate hypotheses about how the code could change under mutation pressure and selection in a way that the organism would still be viable. Mm. We must remember that the one critical, absolutely necessary rule for any evolutionary hypothesis is that essential function not be lost. You cannot be dead and evolve. Nothing really is more essential to the biochemistry of a cell than its genetic code. That is, the way that information stored in DNA and then put into messenger RNA is transcribed and translated finally into protein sequences. If a codon that is coding for serine suddenly codes for phenylalanine, that may very well disrupt protein assembly and cause real deep problems for any cell. So this was a real difficulty. How could this happen? And since that time, that is roughly 1985, We're now looking at about 22 years worth of hypotheses about how the code can evolve. Some of them are more plausible than others, and I think that some of them actually could be tested in terms of the predictions that they
sure.
make. I think that some codon reassignments seem to be very, very hard to understand in terms of any currently existing evolutionary hypothesis, and I look at this in my monograph on this topic.
Mm, very interesting. Well, I guess the final question right now is, who do you think will win American Idol? Or do you watch the show?
I don't watch it. I'm sorry.
Good. Once you start, you can't stop. I unfortunately made the mistake of watching it once this year. And anyway, so thank you very much. We're going to continue on with this discussion with some future podcasts. But Dr. Paul Nelson here talking with us about Common Descent. If you want to vote for Paul as the best podcast, you can... No, we don't actually... have that contest going on, but he is giving us a lot of insight here. So thank you, Paul. Stay tuned for more podcasts. This is Casey Luskin signing off.
Music on ID the Future comes courtesy of composer Yuri Mamchur. Visit www.yuriproductions.com and check out his latest CD, In the Harbor. This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. Discovery President is Bruce Chapman. ID the Future Managing Editor is Robert Crowther. And the producer is Keith Bennett. ID the Future and ID Science in the News is copyright Discovery Institute 2006. For more information, visit www.discovery.org or www.idthefuture.com.